This is CBS Eye on the World, the New World Report with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College. Venezuela. Headlines point to opposition holding a presidential primary in June of 2023. The story. Venezuela's opposition has agreed to hold primary elections in which it will choose a single candidate for the presidency at the end of June 2023, a year from now. Venezuela's 10 main opposition parties determined the date, though it remains unclear what will happen to the country's interim government led by Juan Guaido since January 2019. The general election is said to be held in 2024. However, Venezuela's National Electoral Council has yet to determine a date. Professor, I need help on this because the government of Juan Guaido is in exile, operating outside of the country. The government of Nicolas Maduro, not recognized as legitimate by the United States, is operating inside the country. The last time there was an election, my memory, in Venezuela, it was overwhelmingly untrusted from outside, decried as corrupt and fraudulent. So what we have here is setting another election for next year and a general election in 2024. Are these empty gestures to show what could happen if Maduro was not here? And what does this mean for Guaido's planning for the future, that they're setting elections that we know cannot be run fairly?
As you pointed out, John, this really is the opposition trying to do something and really having no good options before a authoritarian regime which really controls all the cards. I mean, they control the electoral courts and the rules of the game. They, by many standards, have rigged the previous elections. They have basically used Supreme Court rulings and other mechanisms to create alternative means when the Venezuelan opposition previously won control of the Congress. And so one of the recurrent themes over the years, just aside from the fact that there is, it's so rigged that there's no way that the Venezuelan opposition can win, and the power of the state, controls everything, including back in 2020, having actually used Chinese military vehicles to lock the legitimate head of the parliament and President Juan Guaido out of his own congressional building and installing a false Congress. But throughout all this, there has been this recrimination that if only the opposition were more unified. And back before the four key groups came together as the United Democratic Table, the MUD, that was the complaint. And even after that, even after groups split away from the MUD, there was, and really the problem is that when the opposition has had no good options, different members come to different conclusions about, how much of a hard line should you take against this regime, or should you actually try to collaborate with a corrupt criminal regime that has the rules of the game rigged? And so, the latest hope is that while there's almost no hope that the election will be in any way free or fair, but at least there's a theoretical election on the table for 2024. If the Maduro-controlled Electoral Council actually declares that there will be one and says when it will be. And so at least grasping for straws of the ideas to at least present one candidate against Chavismo, against Maduro, rather than having multiple candidates. We'll see if that works. Maduro will continue to work as he has before to co-opt individual members of the opposition. But in my judgment, at the end of the day, until the repressive apparatus of the state, shows cracks, Sabin and DGCIM and FAES and others, there's really very little prospect that any attempts at electoral activity will produce a change. And of course, the illicit money, it continues to keep the Maduro regime alive. The U.S. willingness to negotiate possibly over oil continues to keep them alive. There's been no indication that Maduro will return to the bargaining table in Mexico or elsewhere to have a dialogue about a return to democracy, which is something that Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and others have pushed for. So frankly, in the face of impossible odds and a hopelessly rigged game, God bless Guaido and the opposition for not giving up and keeping hope alive.
The immigration crisis is upon us, and Venezuela is in the news these last days, as you know, Evan, especially in New York, where the mayor, Mayor Adams, has appealed to Washington for help The number I saw recently was 20,000 Venezuelans in New York, and they're making plans as best they can for temporary housing in the East River on Randall's Island. And elsewhere, I've had anecdotal reports of Venezuelans on the East Side just looking lost, sitting on the pavement or doing the best they can, wandering around the city looking for opportunity. Now, there are jobs and there are opportunities, but these are undocumented workers walking from Venezuela. The scale of this tragedy is obvious. I first came across it when a reporter of mine in Panama in the summer of 21 suddenly noticed that people arriving from the infamous Darien Gap, the 60-mile walk through the triple canopy jungle, at great risk to their lives, up and down mountains, through muds, with flash floods all the time, were arriving at the Panama side of the Darien Gap, looking for a ride north all the way and then walking through Mexico. But suddenly the Haitians and Cubans who had been dominating the arrivals were augmented and then eventually matched by young Venezuelans coming through, big-shouldered young men. I saw interviews, and they were looking to come to get to America to find jobs to send money home. That's what they said to my interlocutor. And then this story about Venezuelans now in the thousands crossing into America and through the offices of the Texas governor or other affairs finding their way to New York. There was an incident recently where some Venezuelans, so-called, were flown to Martha's Vineyard by the governor of Florida, is the story. In any event, it's a migration crisis. And the Biden administration has answered it in part, according to Reuters, by granting up to 24,000 Venezuelan humanitarian access to the United States by air. By air, Evan, that doesn't answer what I saw in the Darien Gap, nor the reports that I have from Manhattan. These are not people with the money to spend on air flights. Also, I don't think their papers, their passports, their visas would be in order, and they'd be turned back. They're walking to Texas to come here. You know the story, Evan. So the question is raised, is there any linkage between this immigration crisis and the negotiation in whatever it exists about oil, about returning Venezuela to the world of oil affairs? At one time, they were producing 3.2 million barrels a day. Now they're down in the hundreds of thousands. Are these matters related? Are they separate worlds? Migration crisis into the U.S. and negotiating with Caracas or talking to Caracas about oil?
Well, John, certainly the migrants that you see are a function more than anything of the complete destruction of the economy by, you know, first the mismanagement and then the corruption and then the associated violence and the repression that have characterized the kind of the deepening control by the Maduro regime. But frankly, this goes all the way back to the early 2000s when Hugo Chavez first came into power. Basically, the repression of the takeover of PDVSA and the end of the national strike back in 2003. However, the number of Venezuelans who have been leaving the country really exploded in about 2019-2020. The current estimates are over 7 million Venezuelans having permanently left, with over 2 million of those in Colombia, but also having gone to other places. Now, in general, the Venezuelans who were of the highest parts of the middle class and who had some money, the ones who had the foresight to get out relatively early with some of the money that they had, they went to places that you could get to by flights. And so, you know, they went to the United States, they went to Europe, they went to a certain degree to other closer in places like for example, the Dominican Republic. Those who had fewer resources tended to migrate from, you know, the core population center there in Caracas down the Cordillera, crossing over the border generally into Cucuta, Colombia, and oftentimes walking, you know, again, going by foot, even as far down to Ecuador, to Peru, even all the way down to Chile and Argentina. What you're seeing now is, some signals of the border being opened by the Biden administration and some hopes that certainly Venezuelans would be increased eligibility for political asylum, and given also signals about the open border in general. You've seen a big shift with large groups of Venezuelans coming to the border. Again, these things are periodic. As you yourself pointed out, you have, based on whatever signals are coming out of Washington, what's being perceived in the region, and what local policies are, you've had big groups of Cubans coming through when Nicaragua opened up an air bridge. You've had groups of Haitians coming in. And so right now, you have a significant movement of Venezuelans. But as you also pointed out, this is really a drop in the bucket. I mean, the Biden administration saying that they are going to let in a symbolic number, 24,000. My understanding is that basically the U.S. government will be the one who pays for this. The Biden administration, with U.S. tax dollars, would be the one who pays for the air transport of 24,000 Venezuelans. But as you also point out, John, the tragedy is that, in this policy would basically say, okay, if you're one of the lucky 24,000, you get to be flown into the United States on U.S. government expense. But if you are the masses of everybody else, you get to stay in Mexico. So under the Trump administration policy, Title 42, which basically uses protocols having to do with COVID-19 to say, okay, you have to stay in Mexico while we process your asylum claim. They're basically saying if you come in through the land border in an agreement with Mexico, you will be left in Mexico. So literally those who came in, who presented themselves at the land border before Wednesday, essentially got in or walked in. Those who will present themselves or have presented themselves after Wednesday today, maybe turn back and have to wait in Mexico. But those who apply for this process, those 24,000 out of many, many more, may get the golden ticket to be flown into the United States. So it's really a very kind of disorderly process, but good meaning people are trying to work through this, but the numbers and the solutions just don't work out, before the vast need for Venezuelans with their collapsed country and the authoritarian repression that exists there, who are trying to migrate by their feet to the United States, among other places.
Professor, you're a veteran of the State Department, and you practice diplomacy routinely. That's your job at the U.S. Army War College, to be diplomatic. In general, speaking of Venezuela, right now we know bad actors are in the capital. Representatives from Moscow, representatives from Tehran, representatives from Beijing. These representatives are not looking to improve the lives of Venezuelans. They have other motives. To my knowledge, the U.S. is not present. That, in history, is a bad face of negotiation. You've got to show up in order to participate with your adversaries in some way making a case to Caracas, to the government there, that there's a better way than siding with violent actors, which is what Moscow, Tehran, and Beijing represent. Is that thinking fresh right now at the State Department? Are they looking to find a way to open a dialogue with Caracas despite all the troubles? Oh, we're not at the table, to my understanding.
Well, let me certainly try to state their position correctly. So first of all, I understand and from the statements by Secretary Blinken that there certainly is no official indication of unilaterally decreasing sanctions in the wake of the lack of willingness of the Maduro administration to come back to the negotiating table in Mexico or really show any other sign of good faith. My understanding is there have been some discussions that have gotten out into the news of Chevron, which continues to have a presence, basically getting exceptions to some of those sanctions. It has certainly wanted to have licenses which would allow it to export oil from its own operations out. Previously, there was exceptions given not only to Chevron, but also to European companies, Eni and Repsol, to export oil to essentially repay themselves for past debts and I think it was hoped, get oil to the United States.
We just have a minute, Evan. Go ahead. 1 minute.
To Europe. My sense is that whatever gestures and those gestures resulted in the hostage releases, the small number of people that we discussed previously, but they really have not caused any significant change in policy by the Maduro administration. And really, it's arguably decreased the Maduro incentives to go to the negotiating table because they're getting the legitimacy by people like President Petro next door, who has reopened the borders to Venezuela and others in the region, like the Peronist regime in Argentina. And so right now, it doesn't seem that any of the gestures are moving us toward democracy in Venezuela, nor does it appear that the U.S. administration is necessarily going to double down to do more in terms of sanctions relief, at least what I can see for the moment.
Professor Amanelis, U.S. Army War College. This is the New World Report. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.